Supposed to be the second thrilling lecture in my series. I mean, it's supposed to be thrilling. It's not going to be. I remind you that the overall framing title for this series of talks is three singular variational problems. And what I'm going to do, or am in the process of doing, is discussing on the three consecutive days some problems that we will eventually see the interpretation of which are quite different. And it's therefore supposed to be interesting. I mean, you're supposed to think it's interesting for the talk that there's a sort of common mathematical framework between them. And at the very least, this is, as I'll try to illustrate as we go on, this will allow us to take sort of technical tricks from one area and use it for the other, and vice versa, and so on. So anyway, the leitmotif. Let me remind you from the slide from yesterday. It's not a good idea to focus on my eyes. I can't actually see. Okay, so anyway, so the leitmotifs, however, this, at the beginning level, are actually quite technical. I mean, I wish I had some sort of big philosophical, you know, story I could say about this, but in reality, it's sort of technical. One of the unifying principles is going to be that in these various models, when I work them out, there will emerge a sort of common pattern, which is a joining of two partial differential equations. One will be a static Hamilton-Jacobi equation, or it's a nonlinear equation of first order. This, typically, I'll write in that form. I'll always mark it with an H for Hamilton or Hamilton-Jacobi, like this. Sometimes it'll be an inequality. Sometimes there'll be something on the right-hand side and so forth, but this particular structure will appear. And with it will be coupled a transporter continuity equation that I mark T here. This has a new unknown, which is sigma. It'll sometimes be a measure, and it'll sometimes be a function, and sometimes something on the right-hand side and so forth. But nevertheless, at sort of a technical level, I'm asserting that one of the things to watch out for is in all of these different models, the advent of such equations, and then, you know, technical tricks to try to exploit that. And also, the other framing device is that they all have sort of a singular variational or approximate variational principle. Okay, so let me, again, pull the slides from last time. And okay, so I did this one last time. Okay, so I did this one last time. You're given a function. You take this particular energy functional. It's an exponential. K is destined to go to infinity. This is why it's singular. I took here the Euclidean length of the gradient of a test function, of a competing function, minus 1, and some term here, which corresponded to an inhomogeneous term. I worked on that, and I argued last time that when you let K go to infinity, what you get is an example of the Monge-Kantorovich mass transfer problem. This is the so-called L1 piece of the theory. Today, well, I'll skip today, and I'll tell you what I'll do next time. So 3 is going to be, so this is a preview, I mean, this was a review, this is a preview. Tomorrow, what I'm going to take is the third problem. I'm going to fix boundary values, that's little g. I'm going to take a singular one, sort of like this, it's sort of stripped down and simplified. The minus 1 isn't there, the f isn't there. And again, I'm going to let k go to infinity to that, and we'll see what kind of structure appears in that particular case. But today's talk is the middle example, which I'll put here. Okay, so in today's lecture, I'm going to take this middle example. This one is sort of intermediate in the complication, and the framework is different. Okay, so the way this one works is I'll be given for all of the talk a function big H that's a function of the vector P and the point X. P and X are in Rn. P will be momentum, X is position, H is the Hamiltonian. This is already foreshadowing that there'll be some kind of appearance of Hamiltonian dynamics. I'm going to assume that this Hamiltonian is periodic in X. This means it's periodic on the flat torus, the unit cube with the opposite faces identified. And I assume it's uniformly convex in the momentum variable that's called P. In any case, then what I'm going to do is I'm now going to form an energy functional, I2. And what I'm going to do is this. First of all, I'm going to do something that at this stage is totally unmotivated. But what I'm going to do is, first of all, I'm going to ask you to give me a vector capital P that's an Rn. This is simply, at this point, just a parameter. It's a kind of external bias I'm putting into the problem. Later, it's going to be a big deal how things change as I change capital P. But for now, it's just something I'm insisting on. And here's what I'm saying. Take the Hamiltonian. I insist you stick that frozen vector capital P inside the Hamiltonian. Then add to it the gradient of a periodic function. The W is from the class script A2 of competing functions. Okay, so this is going to be a fixed vector, kind of a bias, the gradient of a periodic function. I'm going to put a big parameter k destined to go to infinity in front of it, integrate it over the cube. And what I'd like you to do now is to minimize this over all functions w that are periodic, say that mean value is equal to 0. You can add a constant, it doesn't matter, so make the mean value equal to 0. And I want you to find vk to minimize this, call w equals vk the minimizer. By calculus of variations, the integrand is extremely convex in the gradient of w, therefore by standard calculus of variations there exists a minimizer. It's in fact smooth, and it's unique in fact. By the way, there was a typo in the notes last time. I called this UK before. That was a typo. It should be called VK if you took careful notes last time. Okay, so anyway, I just introduced this just as in the lecture last time. I just made up something kind of vaguely similar. And what I want to do is let K go to infinity. And I need to worry about analytic control to know if I can pass the limits. I repeat that for any given frozen value of K, the minimizer is a totally smooth function. But like we saw last time, you lose control as k goes to infinity. But more importantly is the interpretation. In other words, why do this? In other words, what interesting structure will emerge when I pass into this particular limit? And indeed, this is going to be what's called a form of what's called weak KAM theory. So KAM theory is the perturbative study in dynamics in which one takes a simple integrable Hamiltonian system and makes a small non-resonant perturbation and shows that you have this integrable structure survives. Weak KAM theory is an attempt to do this sort of in the large. Now, the trouble is weak. They're not kidding when they call it weak. I mean, it turns out you're going to get sort of generalized solutions and so forth. But ultimately, what's supposed to happen is some kind of structure is going to emerge. We'll get at it from PDE tricks, but the raison d'etre is to try to show that it has an interpretation having to do with sort of finding integrable structure in Hamiltonian dynamics. So that's what's supposed to happen. Okay, so I want to do this. I want to let k go to infinity. Before the interesting structure emerges, I need some kind of control of what's going on. And for this, I need a piece of background from PDE theory. And this is the theory of Lyons, Papanikolaou, and Varadon on what are called effective Hamiltonians. Okay, so look, here's what I'm going to do. I want to pass the limits in this one over here. So in order to show, obviously when k goes to infinity, all hell's going to break loose in this. And one hope is that I'll be able to take the energy of a minimizer and compare it with the energy of any other comparison function. So if I can find a class of comparison functions for which something good happens, I can at least use them as a comparison in the energy here to at least get some kind of control. Now, when you look at this, this is going to be, I mean, the bigger h is, when I let k go to infinity, this is going to get tremendously big. And so one idea would be, maybe I can try to dream up somehow a function w, or as a competitor here, something for which this Hamiltonian is pretty well under control. Probably being well under control in the soup norm is a good thing to do, because k is going to go to infinity. Okay, so it turns out, I mean, this is all no accident, but it turns out there's a theorem, a lemma, that arose in work on homogenization theory that I won't talk about here. Let me just give you this sort of technical lemma. And here's what it says. Okay, you give me this vector capital P. You know, don't worry about it yet. I'll do that. Okay, let me try to solve this. Let me try to find a periodic function. I'll call it V hat to distinguish it from VK, which is the minimizer here. And let's try to solve that. Your first guess would be, well, maybe I can solve it equal to 0 on the right-hand side. Okay, but it turns out that, as Lyons, Papanikolaou, and Varadon showed, that there is a unique constant, we'll call it lambda, for which that equation, which I marked with the red star, has a solution. The solution, V hat, is supposed to be periodic in x, and this is kind of like, it's kind of a nonlinear analog, I don't know, like a Fredholm alternative or something in linear equations. A solvability condition, if you want to solve the PDE in star with the red, then the statement here is there's one and only one right-hand side, one real number for which there's a solution, and it's uniquely determined. The real number lambda is unique. It's determined by capital P, so let's give it a name, and let's define h bar of P, just another name for that unique constant lambda depending on P. I won't go through the proof of this. This is a relatively straightforward. And when I talk about solution, I mean solution in the so-called viscosity sense, the weak sense. The solution is not going to be C1, but it turns out in this case it's Lipschitz. Okay, so I'm saying, quoting this theorem, I can solve this for a unique lambda. I'm renaming the lambda here to display its dependence on capital P, or implicitly to define that. Let me also do this. Let me take that periodic function and add to it a plane. So capital P is a frozen vector. This is a linear piece. Now, this is no longer, the whole thing's no longer periodic. It's basically tilted with slope capital P, and it has a periodic modulation on top of it. Let's call that U. And then let me just plug into the PDE here. The right-hand side I renamed H bar of P. The gradient of this U hat is big P plus the gradient of V hat. You can put that in here. And what I've written in the blue box, the second blue box, is just I've just rewritten the equation star above to make it useful. The function H bar P so defined is called the effective Hamiltonian. And one of the mysteries that today's talk is meant to elucidate a little bit is what does it mean? I'm given, let's review the bidding, I'm given a Hamiltonian that's periodic in x, uniformly convex in the momenta lowercase p. Through this indirect recipe on the right-hand board, the solvability condition for a nonlinear PDE, I've generated a new function called h bar of capital P. It's a new function. It turns out that since this guy is convex in little p, it's not very difficult to show this is convex in capital P. Somehow, this is a procedure that's taken, as we'll see, at least the principle is, that the original Hamiltonian, depending on both position and momentum and its trajectories and everything, can be extremely complicated. Whatever I've done here, I've come up with a function now of only momenta, albeit they became capitalized for some reason I'll explain later, and somehow a simplification has occurred or something. And the question is to understand what that means and so on. It is not, for example, you might think, well, this depends on x, this doesn't, well, maybe you just averaged it in x, but it's not. This is a complicated indirect process, and again, the part of the point is to figure out what this is saying. Okay, so anyway, so I introduced this piece of theory off the shelf. Let me also take from theory a min-max formula for it. So it turns out that there is in the PDE literature a fairly extensive study of this. At least initially, this was motivated for us by homogenization issues. But anyway, it turns out that there's a kind of mini-max formula for the solution. And so if this seems too indirect, this recipe for H-bar of P, the effective Hamiltonian, here's another recipe. Freeze capital P, put it at the gradient of a periodic function V of X, max that over points X, min it over C1 functions. And it turns out that's another recipe for the formula. Okay. So in any case, let me go back to the variational problem. Variational problem was this, remember. I'm just repeating the slide. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to change variables similarly to what I did on the slide I took away. V sub k is my minimizer of this variational problem. Okay, the thing with V hat is the solution I got from PDE theory, and that will come up later. Let me add to it a plane, capital P dot x, plus this periodic modulation as before. So again, I'm using the variables in the talk today. The functions V will be periodic in x. The functions U will be a plane with a periodic modulation. So let me define that, and then to try to get the PDE and all the structure to appear, I go to this variational problem and look at the minimizer, and then I can write down the Euler-Lagrange equation. So the Euler-Lagrange equation, you know, again, for if there are any non-experts left, the statement that the derivative of the functional equals to zero at a minimizer, the Euler-Lagrange equation turns out to be a PDE of this particular form. I've absorbed the capital P dependence into here. The gradient of UK is big P. It should be sitting in here, but I've absorbed it into it, plus the gradient of the modulated piece, like this. Okay, so there's the PDE, and what I want to do is let k go to infinity. On the other hand, I first of all have to normalize things so that I don't completely lose control. The Hamiltonian I have could be greater than 1 everywhere, and so when I write e to the kh, that term's definitely going to explode. So let me divide by something to keep some control, kind of a renormalization, and I'm going to do it this way. Okay, so that's an old one. Let me introduce the following definition. Go to the variational principle. Plug into it your minimizer. Okay, I put the capital P in. Okay, but anyway, this is basically the minimum energy I have. I'm worried about this growing exponentially in K as K gets large. So compute the minimum energy, take the log of it, and divide it by K. And I'm going to be interested in what happens to that expression when K goes to infinity. I'm also going to be interested in what happens when I differentiate that in capital P, et cetera, et cetera. The main goal, to say again, is to try to get something to do with dynamics to appear. Okay, let me do that, and then I want to pass the limits in the Euler-Lagrange equation over here, but the particular term I'm pointing to could just blow up and go to plus infinity everywhere. So I'm going to renormalize it so that it becomes a function, a smooth function that has integral 1. So let me do this. Let me define sigma k to be what was lying over here, subtract off something, and if you just work through the logs and stuff, by subtracting off this constant up here, what I'm going to get is I'll have effective normalization so that the ck, which is a smooth function, will be non-negative and will have integral equal to 1. By the way, I wrote in blue that I have no idea if there's any connection. This looks vaguely to me like when you compute free energy in statistical mechanics, when you do something like this. It's, when I let K go to infinity, it's kind of like letting the inverse temperature of beta go to infinity and so forth. If there's anything beyond that, I have no idea, but I thought it looked cool. Okay, so anyway, look at this PDE. You can multiply it by a constant because the right-hand side is 0. So do that, and you can put in this extra little piece. And then let me just summarize it in the blue box. So in this blue box, I've got the Euler-Lagrange equation. I fiddled around with this piece in order to, it's obviously non-negative, but I fiddled around with it so that the integral was equal to 1. Okay, now let k go to infinity. The things I've introduced are supposed to mean something in the limit. So go through here, really through a sequence. It turns out the UKs, it's easy to show that they're uniformly Lipschitz, therefore there's a subsequence that converges uniformly to some limit. This had the form of a plane plus a periodic modulation. The limit inherits that structure. There's therefore a Lipschitz periodic function V of x, such that the limit is a function, again, capital P dot x, the big P will be explained later, plus a periodic modulation. Furthermore, if I look at these functions, they're all smooth. They all have norm 1. I'm on a flat torus. It's compact. So again, passing through a subsequence, I can pass through the limits and get them to converge to something. But since I only have L1 control, in principle, this will converge to a measure. So this structure has appeared in the end, this function. And then the question is, what does it mean? Right, these are Lipschitz functions, therefore converge uniformly. This means uniformly. Right, these are individually, they're smooth functions, smooth positive functions, but I only have a uniform L1 control. Hence, I only know I can extract a measure in the limit. And what you expect in this is that it truly is a measure. Okay, and it's supposed to mean something, you know. Yeah, this is the point. Okay, so here I have, I've skipped some of the estimates and stuff. But, Yeah, pass through it. Yeah, right. So this is really a subsequence. There's no reason to think a different sequence will converge to the same thing. I don't necessarily think these limits are unique. So pass through a subsequence for which this holds. Re-index it. Okay, so what happens is the point. Well, okay, so first of all, the first theorem is this is not surprising given my notation, but I claim that the thing I defined over here, which was the minimum energy log divided by k as a function of capital P, when you let k go to infinity, I assert it converges to the effective Hamiltonian in the sense of Lyon's, Papanikolaou, and Verrandon that I alluded to earlier. In other words, there was a completely separate recipe for it, but I'm saying the same function, it's a convex function of P, comes out in the limit. I'm also interested, as I reminded you at the beginning, about Hamilton-Jacobi type equations, transport equations and stuff come out. And so a first step in this direction, I say that the limit function that I got here, it's Lipschitz, so it's differentiable almost everywhere, and I say that almost everywhere it's less than or equal to this h bar of p. Okay. Now again, that's not exactly the Hamilton-Jacobi, it's an inequality sign, but it's pushing in the right direction. Okay, I'll just say a word about how you prove, for example, 1, and this is what I was alluding to earlier. Almost everywhere means with respect to Lebesgue measure of x until I introduce some other measures, and then I'll try to put them, I'll be more precise. Okay, so the notation makes it so that one is not you know, it's obvious, but just because I made the notation, I should probably prove it. Yeah, I remember once when I took my first delta epsilon calculus course, I had this homework problem, and I had to show one thing was less than another, and I couldn't prove it. So the one thing I called it epsilon, and the other I called big M. You know, so it looked like it was bigger, but the teacher didn't buy it. Okay, so basically chastised by that lesson, I'll try to actually. Okay, so this is what I was saying before. Okay, the VK is a minimizer of this. And at this point, I'm using the VK and displaying the capital P, just like that. Okay, so it's less than or equal to any other competing thing I put in, a periodic function. So I can take this VK with a hat. This came from the Leon's Papanikolaou Veradon, and put that in as a competer. And the energy will only go up, because VK without a hat, without a circumflex, is a minimizer. But I reminded you, this thing here is a solution of this equation. Remember, the theorem was there was a unique constant lambda, which I've renamed h bar of p, such that you can solve Lebesgue almost everywhere. That PD holds in the viscosity sense. Okay, so what I can do is, everywhere I have here, I can substitute this constant, h bar of p. And at this part of the talk, the p is just a parameter. It'll be varied later, but not yet. Okay, so you do that. You then take the log and divide by 1 over k, and you get this expression is less than, I had e to the k h bar. I took log 1 over k. You get h bar like that. And this, on the other hand, is just the definition of what the hk bar is. Okay, so this proves that the limb soup of this is less than or equal to h bar of p. That's part of what I'm trying to say in 1. I'm saying the actual limit is that. So I won't put all the details in. I'll just fix it up. It turns out that if you... I think I lost it. Anyway. Okay, so it turns out... Okay, let me try to juice this up and say, all right, now what if the limb inf were strictly less than that? That would be bad. Well, if the limb inf were strictly less, it would be less by some positive number epsilon. And it turns out if you analyze what's going on, it will turn out that from that you'll be able to deduce that the limit function u is not only less than or equal to h bar of p, it's less than or equal to by a little positive number, say epsilon over 2. And the trouble is that cannot be true, because that would contradict the minimax formula here. And it's a slight problem here. The V is C1. Here it's only Lipschitz, so you have to regularize and use mollifiers and so forth. But in any case, if this were strictly less, then you would be able to find a subsolution that dropped down by this constant, a contradiction to this particular formula here. And so that doesn't happen. The limb inf is not strictly less than that. Therefore, the identity 1 holds. And I didn't do it, but the technology that went into this similarly proves, too, that the limit almost everywhere must be less than or equal to h bar. So again, you see, this variational principle, it has this exponential piece in it. The exponential piece involves this. The solution is trying, desperately to get that this exponent is small as it can be everywhere in the soup norm. And somehow we know, we already, from theory I had in other parts of PDE, we saw that that's sort of uniquely plucking out this constant h bar of p. So again, this is not saying it's good for anything, but this is sort of another take on that somehow this is, given a Hamiltonian h of little p and little x, you fool around with it and you get this new, call it a Hamiltonian h bar of p. This is sort of more, albeit indirect, evidence that this is interesting for some reason. Okay, so I want to now pass to more limits. I really have in mind to talk about dynamics. The measure sigma I have is lying in the x space. I really haven't said anything about it. I want to think of x as being position. It's on the unit torus. And I want to lift now into velocity space. So the velocity I'll denote by the letter lowercase v. This will be another direction, which is rn direction. So what I propose you do next is take the measure sigma k, or the function sigma k, and use it, lift it to be a measure lying in Rn, in Tn, the x variables cross Rn, where the velocity variables lie, by lifting it according to this recipe. Now, I want to try to explain this very well, but if you go through sort of sort of standard formalism in dynamics and so forth, in Hamilton and Lagrangian dynamics, this recipe is suggested. Anyway, whenever I write this, this is where the x variables are, where you have this. I have Lipschitz estimates on this. They're uniform in K. These measures are therefore, tight. And I can extract a subsequence that converges as a measure. And this is now a measure on velocity and position space. I'm not sure what you call this in dynamics. Phase space, I think, is momentum and position space. I'm not sure. What do you call velocity and position space? Configuration space? Well, it's the tangent. Okay, it's the tangent. Right, okay. Anyway, so what I've done now is sort of I've lifted this sigma k, which was converging to a measure sigma in the x variables. I've lifted it into velocity variables, and I've extracted another subsequence and gotten a measure here. I want to explain what that measure is for. To do so, I pause to introduce two pieces of notation. I have a measure now that I built here. You see, the measure is supposed to be interesting. You know, that's why I'm leading up to this. Okay. So I have this measure on position and velocity variables. Let me define capital V to be the average velocity. It's a probability measure. To be the average velocity. Furthermore, I have this convex function h bar of p. Whenever one sees a convex function, you just instinctively write down the Legendre transform of it. This will be called the effective Lagrangian. You know, it's like you have a PDE, multiply by U, integrate by parts. You have a convex function, do the... Okay. So anyway, let me introduce as well the effective Lagrangian, which is the Legendre transform of the effective Hamiltonian. Okay, so what is happening is I'm leading up to interpreting something in terms of Lagrangian dynamics, and that's why I'm segueing over from the original sort of variational stuff in the x variables into velocity space, trying to set up the machinery for that. Okay, then theorem. The limit measure mu I get satisfies an identity like this. This is a form of flow invariance. Let me not say more about that. I say, with respect to this new measure, this particular formula holds. I'll comment about that more in a second. Most importantly for our purposes is the occurrence of the pair of equations that I've said we'll see occur over and over again in this talk. We saw earlier that the limit function u I built, this was sort of the limit of the minimizers with the plane biased in, was less than or equal to this Lebesgue almost everywhere. I can now fine-tune that by saying, in fact, I have equality on the support of the measure sigma. A picture will appear in a second. I have a measure, mu, that's in x cross v space. Its projection of the x variables is sigma. I forgot to write that down. And what I'm saying is, Lebesgue almost everywhere, the inequality holds. Sigma almost everywhere, u is differentiable, and you have equality there. And I'm sure everybody's completely, including me, is blanked out from yesterday's lecture, but although the context was radically different yesterday, a similar thing occurred. I had a measure sigma that was supposed to be a Lagrange multiplier of a constraint that the gradient of u be less than or equal to 1. And we had sort of a similar thing. Always something was less than or equal to, in this case, it's a constant, h bar of p, but you had equal on a particular, in this case, a measure. In addition, if you reinterpret this flow invariance, it turns out that the measure is a weak solution of this transport equation. A weak solution is defined by integration by parts against a smooth test function, and it makes sense to define that even for a measure. It turns out this is continuous on the support of the measure. I mean, you can make sense of this. Yeah, question? I'm saying that when you have the flow invariant property and you know that in this direction, I'll draw this in a picture, that you can interpret it like this. And this is a picture now only in the x variables. I sort of lifted to the velocity variables, past the limits, and I'm dropping back. And I'm doing that because I'm trying to get the PDEs, the pair of PDEs, the H for Hamilton-Jacobi, the T for transport or continuity equation to appear together. So it's not clear that this means anything at this stage. It's just I sort of managed to get these same PDEs to appear. It's kind of interesting, you know, but it still doesn't, you know, I still haven't shown you this means anything anybody cares about or not.
Great.
I'll do the Hamiltonian in a second. Yeah. Right. Right. So one of the things I'm leading up to is Walter. Yeah. It's going to be I'm trying to get more and more stuff about dynamics into this. And for a while now, I'm in Lagrangian mode, and then I'm going to switch using the Legendre transform to Hamiltonian mode. And the PDE apparatus that's now appeared inside this blue box is supposed to mean something and be useful for that. Anything else? Okay, so actually, the picture appears in a second, but first of all, let me try to draw a connection with what I built here as the limit k goes to infinity of the singular variational problem. Let me draw the connections with something already well known to those who know it well, which is Mather's variational principle and Lagrangian dynamics. Okay, I'm not going to motivate this. I'm going to say that Mather, in a part of what we're now sort of subsuming under what's called weak KAM theory, introduced the following variational problem. This is not a PDE problem. Okay, suppose you have a Lagrangian, and here I mean the Lagrangian to be the Legendre transform of the Hamiltonian that I had before. Okay, you give me a probability measure. Let me take the Lagrangian and integrate it with respect to this probability measure on position and velocity space. One can think of that as being the, quote, action of the measure by analogy to the action of a curve, which is the Lagrangian being evaluated along the curve with v equals x dot. And suppose you were asked, or more precisely, suppose Mather asked you to minimize that action amongst measures satisfying the conditions that I marked as 1, 2, and 3. A sort of flow invariance condition, a given average velocity, which I'm calling capital V, and it's supposed to be a probability measure. So I am not attempting to motivate this anywhere, but what I'm saying is that the structure that appeared on the left transparency for my singular variational problem by letting K go to infinity dovetails perfectly with this problem in the literature, which is to minimize the action of a measure subject to some constraints. It turns out, theorem, the minimum that you can attain that's a function of the prescribed average velocity v, that minimum is L bar of v, which is the same L bar of v that appears over here. Okay. And weak KAM theory, so Albert Fatty named this, is one way of saying it is to try to understand, just forget all the junk I talked about, just look at this slide. One way of saying it is, it's not very, Mather showed that there exist minimizers to this problem, and to try to understand the structure of these minimizing measures. They're supposed to contain information about about dynamics. That's good. That's the reason for this. And so one definition of the subject weak KAM theory is an attempt, for example, to take this minimizing measure and to try to use whatever to try to understand the structure of it. And so what I'm trying to sell over here is that this particular structure is appearing from this singular variational problem that's not over here. In other words, this is kind of an attempt to introduce PDE tools that have something to do with this. And indeed, it turns out, maybe I forgot to say it, but it turns out the thing I built here, this measure, is in fact a minimizing measure in this sense, although it's built by a different method. Okay. Question? Okay, so however you get at it, the goal of this subject is to try to understand the structure of a minimizing measure mu. The one I built here, I'm using the same letter mu because it is a minimizing measure. And so, for example, this is a theorem of Mather, for example. This minimizing measure is, in fact, not just, its support is not just some blob. It's, lies on a Lipschitz graph lying above the x variables. Say that again. Here's the x variables in the unit cube. There's a graph going into Rn, a Lipschitz graph, on which lies the support of this measure. The support of the measure is a flow invariant set under the Lagrangian dynamics, which I wrote here as L for the Lagrangian dynamics. And because, you see, it's not a crazy fractal thing bent over itself, it's in fact lying on a Lipschitz graph, it's supposed to be kind of a nicer structure lying within what may be otherwise very extremely complicated Lagrangian dynamics. Anyway, the fact that it lies on a Lipschitz graph is a famous theorem of Mather. On the other hand, just because it's lying on a Lipschitz surface doesn't mean it is a Lipschitz surface, and in general one expects it to be some kind of a Cantor-like set or something. I suppose it could be a periodic orbit, but in general some sort of a Cantor-like set lying on this Lipschitz graph, so it's not, you know, it's not necessarily that nice. And anyway, and so to repeat, part of the goal of the project is to, or at least what I and my collaborators have done, is to try to see if the PDE tools that we brought to bear have something additional that can help, or at least to recover some of the results. So forth. Yeah. Yes. Right. It could be separate pieces. Right. Right. It could be that they're separate pieces, each of which are right. Like that. See, it could be that given a capital V, you have to piece together several other things which individually had different big V's, but they're average with that. No. Although that reminds me, so part of the philosophy of this is, you see. In mechanics, if you have a curve x of t, so this is now a curve, dot means ddt, and if you have a curve that satisfies the Lagrangian equations, that's saying it's a critical point of the action, and the physical principle is that the motion in the mechanical system is a critical point of the Lagrangian. This procedure, it's in sort of funny language, introduced the approach of Mather, what it's doing is it's focusing attention on minimizers, and in particular, on solutions of this that for all time are not only critical points, i.e. solutions of Lagrangian equations, but are minimizers of the action. And the hope is, I mean, it's a principle in the calculus of variations that, you know, critical points are good, but minimizers should be better and have better properties. And so that's sort of a philosophy that's guiding some of this. Okay, so anyway, that's what the project is. I haven't shown you that we can do it. And to push forward, I'm now going to move to, in fact, literally I'm going to push forward to from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian, and I'm now going to change the Hamiltonian variables. Now, in other words, as a PD person, I know about Hamilton-Jacobi equations and stuff, so probably I should switch to Hamiltonian variables, you know, so this will pay off, and so I'll do that here. Call what age? Okay, that's good. Good one. Somebody get him out here. Okay. Are there guards I can have? Didn't I threatened to do that yesterday. You've been warned. Yeah. Yeah, well. Okay. I'm editing out various comments because I'm. Yes, no. Okay. See, the audio, I want the audio to be nice while I'm streaming. I say, oh, that's very nice. Okay. So as long as the audio is good, no evidence. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to move over to the Hamiltonian side. So I remind you that if you have a curve, and if you take the gradient of the Lagrangian and the V variables, and then that gives you a function P of T, which is the Hamiltonian, the generalized momentum along that. And, of course, if you then take the Lagrangian equations, Euler-Lagrange equations, you rewrite them as the Hamiltonian system. Here I performed Legendre transform from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian back again. And so this is supposed to be the original, the H that I was talking about at the very beginning. And now I think it's correct to call it a Hamiltonian because I have the Hamiltonian structure here. So what I did was I just moved to the Hamiltonian side. Okay, why does one do that? Well, it's good for motivational issues at least, because once you have dynamics in Hamiltonian variables, then you can bring to bear the huge, at least formal machinery of doing canonical changes of variables in the Hamiltonian side. So let me, on this slide, tell you how you do that, or remind you how you do that. So one of the big deals is that if you're in, over here, and I have this flow in position and momentum variables, and I just drew a typical blue trajectory. That's supposed to be a typical trajectory of this. And over here, it's supposed to look complicated. And then the idea is that if you can change under a canonical change of variables, if you change variables under a canonical change of variables to new position variables, I'll call capital X, new momenta, which I'll call capital P, then, you know, if you do, then the theorem is it preserves the Hamiltonian structure. And then, in particular, if you do this in a careful way, you might be able to change it so that in the new dynamics, the evolution is trivial. I guess the easiest thing would be then, is basically what I got here. So suppose I can somehow magically change variables. and I magically can convert to a new Hamiltonian in the system. But the new Hamiltonian doesn't depend upon the variable capital X. So if you took a system like this, and put capital letters now, but if the Hamiltonian did not depend upon capital X, this would be zero, which is what I've written here. And therefore, P is constant, therefore this is trivial, and the dynamics are a straight line. So if one can change variables like this, and this is fabulous, and the integrating the equations becomes trivial. Okay, how do you do this? Well, one idea is, the formalism of this, is to introduce a generating function. So suppose you have a function little u that's a function of capital, of the mixed variables. It's a function of capital P, the new momentum, and little x, the old position. Okay, suppose it's smooth and so forth. And then change variables implicitly according to the formulas written in this green circle. The little p is the gradient in x of the generating function. Big X is the gradient in capital P of the generating function. And now, of course, what I have in mind is that this u is the same u that I've been talking about from before. It depended upon x, you know, we saw that, and it also depended upon the capital P. Up until now, the capital P was just a fixed parameter that I stuck into the problem. And I'm now explaining why it was there. And it's there because if I could, you know, if little u were smooth enough to carry out the differentiations in the green circle, and if I could take this implicit formula, solve for big X's and big P as functions of little x and little p, globally, whatever, then if you track through all the formalism and so forth, this is good. This is the complicated dynamics become trivial dynamics, and that's great. Now, the trouble is that you can't do this in general. I mean, if this were, you know, if you could in general do this, then Lagrangian flows or equivalently Hamiltonian flows would all be integrable, at least in some theoretical sense. And yet one knows these days that there are chaotic flows in general. So there are many problems. One of them is you can't find a generating function. And one thing I forgot to say is I needed in this the fact that the generating function solved the appropriate PDE that was called the corrector equation before. I'm sorry, I forgot to say. Anyway, you can't do this because it doesn't have a smooth solution in the first place. You don't know it's differentiable in capital P. You can't really carry this out and so forth and so on. On the other hand, it's interesting, and it's a sort of a formal calculation. And so one of the, to revise the goals or to add to the list of goals of the weak KAM theory, then is to see if some part of this picture can be salvaged rigorously, you know, with all the machinery that I've built up heretofore. Okay, the answer is some of it can, but not much for all this. Okay, so with that then, I go back to the beginning. I go back to, this is the first slide I put up. I go back to this calculation, wrong one. Nah, well, I lost it, so. Okay, well, I lost it, so I'll put that one back, sorry. Never mind. Okay. Anyway, so let me go back now to what I talked about at the very beginning, which is the singular variational approximation. So if I could find the slide, I'd put it up. Okay, so remember I wrote e to the kh. I put the big P in the exponent plus a periodic thing, and then I minimized that. Okay, and so that gave me, and then when I added the p dot x, that gave me the minimization. So the point of it is this. The singular variational approximation is giving me, for each finite value of k, smooth guys. The function u is smooth. The sigma that was destined in the limit to become the measure, the sigma k's are smooth guys that are destined in the limit k goes infinity to become this measure sigma, which has information about dynamics. In any case, part of the point of this is, and I'll try to give justification, is that on these smooth guys, I can differentiate as much as I want. You can even differentiate in capital P and so forth. And what I can attempt to do is to do various calculations, try to make, for example, estimates independently of K that will then presumably obtain in the limit when I let K go to infinity, therefore giving me estimates for the limit thing. The limit strategy, if one comes at this just straight from some Mather theory and so forth, you simply have this minimizing measure. Even if you then happen to know there's this PDE from Leon's Papanikolaou and Verdon, these things are not smooth, and you can't start differentiating away and so forth. In particular, you can't even you can't do this. And so go back to the smooth guys. Maybe you can do some calculations. Okay, so here I'm going to start with sort of to advertise this, a typical kind of L2 estimate. Now, this particular one, I'm sort of not going to show what it's for. I'm just going to demonstrate how the estimate holds. And this is supposed to illustrate, it's similarly to a calculation I did last time. I rushed it last time, like I'll rush this one, which is that I have the Euler-Lagrange equation. I can write it in this particular form here. I'm introducing little h, there should be a k here, as shorthand for the exponent up there. Well, I'll simply drop the superscript k. Okay, so this is the Euler-Lagrange equation. This was called sigma k before. I want to display it written as e to the k, big H, and so forth, written like that. These things are smooth, and so the hope is that by fooling around, using the maximum principle, using integration by parts and whatever, that I can try to get some estimates independently of k. In the totally different context of the Monge-Kantorovich mass transfer problem last time, I showed you can multiply something and integrate with parts, and I want to illustrate that at least. So this is, again, sort of just sort of a technical thing, but it's sort of interesting. I say, take the Euler-Lagrange equation, multiply it by the Laplacian of U, and integrate by parts. Now, U is not periodic. It's P dot X plus a periodic thing, but its Laplacian is periodic. Its gradient is periodic. So you do that, write this out. I have two derivatives on U here. Put one of them over here, integrate one of the other ones over, like this. So everything is periodic. There are no boundary conditions here. You get an expression like this, carry out these differentiations. I can differentiate this, for example, in the gradient plot, and I differentiate it, it's already PI, I differentiate PK, out pops the derivative UXK XJ, and I have this. So the point is, I have a term like this. This is actually a good term, as I illustrated in red above it, because the Hamiltonian is supposed to be uniformly convex in P, and so this particular term is good because it's going to allow me to control the second derivative of U. Everything should have a superscript K. I just dropped it for notational simplicity. I then differentiate this in other slots, and then I differentiate this. When you differentiate this piece, now this piece is destined to become a measure. Okay, so this is not smooth independently of k. When you differentiate this, some stuff falls out, and this k falls out. Okay, this is bad. And when everyone does these calculations, this is the problem, is that the limit thing is actually going to be sort of singular. And so you can't just naively expect to have these nice estimates and stuff going on. On the other hand, I won't belabor the details of this so much. This last term, which I call the dangerous term, You can still fool around, combine things, read again, integrate by parts, and so forth and so forth. I get the K to appear, to manifest itself in a term that has the good sign. The other appearances of K's, I combine them into a total derivative and integrate it by parts again, and some extra stuff appears. Anyway, the conclusion of all this is that I have one good term here, which I'm recording like so. I have another good term here, which fortunately has the same sign as that one. All the other junk you can just estimate into a constant and use elementary inequalities for. So this particular calculation, I'm just sort of illustrating the tricks and so forth, but versions of this in some earlier work, Gomes and I used to sort of give a new proof of Mather's theorem about the support of the minimizing measure lying on a Lipschitz surface and some other things we push forward. So again, this is just to try to illustrate that in some cases, this PDE, in spite of the singular term, you can still kind of integrate by parts if you're careful with the dangerous terms. I think more interesting is going to be my second application, and this is another attempt to explain why introducing the singular variational problem is interesting. This gets a little bit in a direction which I think is the real, I hope that there can be a breakthrough in the subject, and I hadn't made it, but. And what I want to do is I want to introduce a non-resonance condition. So in regular KAM theory, when one talks about perturbations of an integrable system, you need what's called a non-resonance condition. Now in this particular case, here's what it means. Let capital V, as before, be my average velocity. I can't remember if I said this or not. It turns out at least if the effective Hamiltonian is differentiable at capital P, it turns out to be the gradient of it. Let me assume the effective Hamiltonian is differentiable at p. That's true for almost every p. Suppose that this vector is non-resonant. That means if you take the dot product with any vector of integers, you never get zero. I should say for experts in real KAM theory, I do not require a Diophantine condition or anything. I don't require a lower bound on this, just that not be zero for every vector of integers. So what this means is that the components of V are not rationally related to each other. And now the question is, what conclusions can I draw from that trying to use the PDE theory? Well, I want to exploit this, and I want to use my smooth approximations. And in particular, I want to use my smooth approximation to the function h bar of p. The effective Hamiltonian is supposed to have interesting information in it. The effective Hamiltonian is a convex function of p, but there's no reason why it's a smooth convex function of p. On the other hand, this approximation thing, at the very beginning of the talk, I wrote log something something 1 over k, and I called that the hk bar. That turns out it's a smooth function in all the variables. Okay, it turns out I can actually differentiate this thing in capital P, and you get some formula I wrote in black. It doesn't matter what it is, but it's just I can carry this particular thing out. It's easy to see from this, by the way, that it's convex in P, although we knew that for other reasons. So what I'm saying is you can just differentiate the approximators. I've left the superscripts on now to emphasize these are the approximators. They're smooth, and it's legitimate to differentiate them even in P as well. And, you know, you can carry out this calculation and regroup the terms, and you get some mess like that, which I've written down. Now, it is interesting because if I set the two indices L equals to M, this term over here is greater than or equal to 0, which is showing the convexity and so forth. But it's also showing that if I had some control on the second derivatives of the H bar case, then it gives me control of the terms on the right-hand side of the equal signs in the black formula, and it might be useful for something. So anyway, this is just a calculation. I won't do this for you. But what I propose to use it for is a theorem like this. This is not a satisfactory theorem, but it's pushing in the right direction. Okay, so here's what I'm saying. Let's suppose, in addition to requiring that h bar of p be differentiable at a point, let's say that the second derivatives of these guys are bounded independently of k. I have to say, I'm not entirely sure how to check that. I think generically that's true, but anyway, let me just assume that. And let me assume also the non-resonance condition. The non-resonance condition is this. Okay, now here's what I'm saying. Take my smooth solution of the approximate problem, differentiate it in capital P. Integrate it with respect to this smooth function that's in the limit is the density, will become the measure sigma, and let k go to infinity. And I claim that if you stick that in to any periodic function, you know, smooth periodic function capital C, what you get in the limit is the average of C over the torus. Okay. Now, and I'm going to give a PDE proof of this. Now, the interest, such as there is that this is a piece of evidence that this project of the weak KAM theory can kind of work. The interpretation is this. I earlier said that if little u, forget the superscript k, just u, as a function of big P and little x, if it were smooth, you know, everything worked, you could use it as a generating function to change from the little x, little p variables to the capital X, capital P variables. And in the latter variables, the dynamics, the Hamiltonian dynamics, would be a straight line. Indeed, in these variables, big X dot was the gradient of H bar of P, which is V. I've assumed that V has a non-resonance condition. That means if I'm in the capital X variable, I can think of this as a flow around the torus. You can think of space as just being copies of the torus, and it's just a straight line. But what we should do is think of it as being wrapped around the flat torus and so forth. So this is supposed to be a trajectory of the curve big X of t, which is in the space variables, the capital letters, from the original complicated dynamics in the lowercase x and p variables. If you could really do this, if everything was smooth and you could really do this, you would get this flow. It's a linear flow, I mean, straight line wrapped around. Furthermore, because of the non-resonance condition, if you ran this for a long time and wrapped it around, it becomes uniformly distributed, like Lebesgue measure. What's written up here is a rigorous statement that is consistent with that. Now, I can't really differentiate U with respect to P. I can't carry this out. I think it's definitely not differentiable in P. Okay, but the smooth guys are. So I can do this. I integrate it with respect to this measure, and then I pass the limits. The point is, if you could do all these other changes, variable and everything is smooth, the effect of this is, to, in effect, to average phi along this trajectory. Because of the non-resonance condition, it should become just the average over the torus. Now, all those intermediate steps, I don't know how to make sense of, but the conclusion is correct. I say again, by itself, this is, you know, nothing to go into cardiac arrest about, but still, what it is, it's showing that there's a chance that you can do rigorous things that are consistent with the dynamical systems interpretation. Let me quickly show you how to do that. Yeah. Yeah, if regular KAM theory applied and everything, I mean, of this? No. I mean, there is not a smooth invariant torus. Now, this measure, the Mather set, the support of this measure that lies on the flip surface is the analog of the invariant torus. I'm hardly an expert on these things, I'm sure, because I'm wired. I'm sure I'll say something stupid that will be preserved for posterity. But I think the heuristic is something like, if you take, you do regular KAM theory, you start to do a big torus, then if you go make the perturbations too big, the tori start to break up and develop holes and stuff. The support of this measure is what survives. And so it should be thought of. And now, this thing exists in the large. There's no condition anywhere of anything smallness like that. That's what I'm saying. Now, heuristically, that's what it should be, because if I could change variables, it would have a flow with non-resonant. You know, if you had an irrational tilt on this and you wrapped it around, it would explore the whole torus. Okay. So I think this is kind of interesting. It's kind of like, okay. Now, of course, I don't have time to do this, but okay. So anyway, let me just say it. Okay. So I want to prove this. So I'm going to take for the phi a piece of a trigonometric, just e to the I m dot x. I plug this in like so, and I use the transport equation. 0 is equal to this because of the transport equation. The transport equation gives me this. I then carry out the differentiation, and I get some expression like so. Okay, this depends on x. This is hard to control. On the other hand, I had this formula that allowed me, in which I managed to talk about the second derivatives of this, and I'm assuming the second derivatives are bounded. This means that I can control a term like this. That means an expression like I'm pointing at here, I can replace with an expression like this. There's a k here, I can divide through by the k over there. So anyway, if I do that, I wrote it in blue, what I did here. I took this expression, this thing here was sort of complicated. I put in this piece and I subtracted it back out. This piece here does not depend on x. I can pull it outside the integral. And what I'm trying to say, I'm saying this broke down into two pieces. This piece is an error piece. It can be estimated by an expression like that. But because I'm assuming this is bounded and I have a k here, I can divide through. And as k goes to infinity, this term will go away. Therefore, 0 equals this term that went away and this. This term in the limit becomes that. This part I pulled outside is not 0 because the non-resonance condition, if the vector m is not 0, therefore the thing inside goes to 0. Therefore, if you take this particular periodic function for any ilm that's a vector of integers not equal to 0, you get in the limit, you get 0. Therefore, if you take any finite trigonometric polynomial, all the higher ones, and the limit goes to 0, only the zeroth term, which gives you the average, survives. Those are dense in the soup norm, and therefore it's true for any periodic function. So this particular calculation, I've done versions of this in various papers I've written. I really can't push beyond it. I've been trying like crazy to do that. So it's the only time I've managed using the PDE methods to use the non-resonance condition. And it's not used in the context of small divisors. You see, I didn't require any Diophantine equation. This seems to be a different use of it. But on the other hand, I've for years now been unable to push it even slightly further. Okay, so I think this is encouraging, although, again, not quite yet. Let me abuse your patience and slap one further slide on here. Another project I've been trying to do, this is also kind of a failure, is to find quantum interpretations of this. I set this up, the only reason I'm doing it is I set it up last time. I wrote Schrodinger's equation, and I suggested that if you did a naive WKB expansion and you matched up the order 1 and order of H terms, you get our equations that we were talking about. This is for sigma being a squared, the amplitude squared, and for the Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian is down here. W is supposed to be a periodic function now. Okay, this suggests, since I've been getting, on the other hand, these equations to pop out, in particular with the material earlier, it suggests that I try to reverse the process. So for example, take sigma k, which is what I built today, it's a smooth function, uk is what I built today, it's a smooth function, define psi k to be this. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to reverse the process I did last time. If you plug this in, the right call, put the Schrodinger equation over here, define that to be r of k, which is the error term. If I could show that there was really good error estimates on this remainder term, then one would call the psi k a good quasi-mode for the Schrodinger's equation, and one can deduce spectral information. This is a project, it sounds good. I've written several papers in which I've sort of gotten some error estimates that they aren't very good. So I should really leave this as an open question. I think that this structure, that, again, it'll also come up in a different context tomorrow, I've managed to build so rigorously solutions, smooth or approximate solutions of this, and that suggests you one could try to go backwards and see if it had anything to do with the Schrodinger equation. This is something, it's not impressive, the kind of error estimates that make it. It's not clear I can really push on this, but I thought it sounded good to talk about the quantum analog. Okay, thank you so much. I'm sorry for going off.